Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Talking to Ourselves podcast. I am Omid Farhang. My guest today is a good one, Charisse Hughes, Chief Marketing Officer at Kellogg's. Charisse is a graduate of Howard University. She earned her MBA from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, foreshadowing. She worked her way up at some of the most iconic global companies. She's been a brand manager at Sara Lee. She was the senior marketing manager at Avon. She was the senior vice president of global marketing at Estee Lauder, where she spent nearly a decade. She then went on to be CMO at Pandora, which is the world's largest jewelry brand. In September of this year, amid the pandemic, Charisse became the global CMO at Kellogg's, overseeing one of the most iconic lineups of consumer packaged goods, including most of the cereals you grew up with, like Rice Krispie Treats and Frosted Mini Wheats and Special K, snacks like Cheez-Its and Pop-Tarts, and newer brands like Morningstar Farms and RX Bar, just to name a few. She is an innovative and strategic brand builder, now helming the lead marketing role at one of the legendary companies in all of industry. This is Charisse Hughes and I talking to ourselves. We like to start every conversation in the same place, Charisse, which is, where are you from and what did your parents do?
So I am from Chicago. I'm a native Chicagoan and a proud one at that. My mother actually is still there, my aunts, uncles, and I grew up in a single parent household. So it's just she and I, an only child. And my mother is actually from a town called in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. So she's a Southerner. So I have like both Midwestern and Southern roots values, let's put it that way. So funny enough, my mom is one of nine children. And so, yeah. So a big family, lots of cousins. She was the first to attend college and she ended up getting like graduating from college in 3 years. Then she went on to get like two master's degrees. And she was an educator for 33 years. So it set a foundation for me about education and lifelong learning. So it's a value that I still hold very dear to me. Which is why I've actually changed industries, because I'm constantly like seeking kind of a new approach or to learn something different or to be challenged in a different way. So it speaks to who I am, which is funny when I think about it.
The educator's daughter is held to a different standard.
It is. Oh my God. It's a standard that I don't know what to say about, but it is what it is. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And what did 13-year-old Charisse want to be when she grew up?
I actually wanted to be a pediatrician, which I actually don't even know why, frankly. I don't know who I would have. Actually, that's not true. My neighbor, who was one of my very dear friends across the street, across the hall from me, her dad was a doctor and they moved away when we were like in like fifth grade or something. And so I think I always just kind of was like, oh, you know, be a doctor. And it's also a pretty easy profession to kind of latch onto, doctor, lawyer, you know.
Sure.
So
I was the same way. I kind of feel like when you grow up, you don't have exposure to that many professions.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I guess it's either doctor or lawyer or loser, and there's not really anything else.
Exactly. Or teacher, because all of my mother's friends were teachers.
Right.
But so this was the one doctor that I knew, which was interesting.
And given your foundation in education, I'm sure your mother was very proud the day that you left for Howard University. How did the experience attending Howard shape you?
Oh, it was probably, it's one of the most memorable experiences of my life, but you also have to know that growing up in Chicago is like the center of Black excellence. So it was just the next step, right? It was the expectation that I was going to, you know, the best historically Black college. I'm sure somebody would want to debate that with me. But of course we have now the VP elect, and I share this amazing university as an alma mater. So yeah. But it's a nurturing environment. It's one where, you sort of can let your guard down and just be who you are. You know, as a Black woman walks into the room every single time. And you can just imagine, you know, what it's like to kind of let loose of that and just be who you are and kind of discover and grow in that environment. It was it was unbelievable. And I still am very close to many of my friends that I had there, and still go back for homecoming when I can. And unfortunately, wasn't able to do that this year. I actually have a goddaughter that is a freshman. She's supposed to be at Howard right now, but of course wasn't able to go because of the pandemic. So she's remote, but looking forward to have her matriculate there next year. So
having friends who are still there and going back for homecoming, I mean, just give me 15 seconds on some of the text chains that must have been popping off when you came to learn that a fellow Howard Bison had just become vice president elect.
Oh, I mean, you know, she's a boss. I mean, all of the wonderful things that you hear, like she's in a different sorority than I am. But there's amazing unity and excitement around just, you know, this school. We call it the Mecca for a reason. Yeah. Because it is that. And it birthed now the first VP elect, which is just, it's not a surprise, but it absolutely is. About time, and we're just thrilled.
Yeah. You went on to graduate school at Northwestern. What was that first big job that gave you a foot in the door after you got your MBA at Northwestern?
Yeah, I mean, so my first job was, I worked for Sara Lee, and I was, and so I had done, when I was an undergrad, when I was at Howard, I majored in finance. And so I kind of chose this role at Sara Lee, which is kind of a hybrid. So a little bit of finance, a little bit of business development. So it was the internal M&A role where you do it for 2 years and then you go into a business unit. And so in that role, I actually got, it was cool because I got a chance to acquire a company and divest a company. So I acquired a coffee company from Quaker Oats. Which really cool. So that was just an amazing experience. And then got to the opportunity to go into a marketing role. And that took me from Chicago to New York. And that role, I think, was probably the most pivotal, one of the most pivotal, because it introduced me to New York and to fashion. And that was leading or being a marketer on Ralph Lauren Intimates. And Intimate Apparel was one of the key business units within Sara Lee. And we were basically licensing the Ralph Lauren name and launching that line into department stores. So it gave me that exposure to fashion and trend and New York and everything that is amazing about being in that city.
How might a colleague describe a young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed Charisse Hughes in her first month at Sara Lee? Were you about that big company life right from the start? Or was there a part of you that was like, I'm going to do this for a little while, but I'm an entrepreneur?
Honestly, all these companies that I've worked for, I was reflecting on it when I was preparing for this conversation. Every company that I've worked for is a big company, but at its heart is a really small company, really, really scrappy and entrepreneurial. I mean, I was like the only marketer that was like one forecasting person on the Ralph Lauren Intimates team. Like there was nobody. So it was super scrappy. And so it was just like getting in there. I was telling my, I have a bonus daughter last night about the hang tags that we had to create and how we had to go in and set up the fixture in Macy's and like truly like doing all of that legwork and executing. You know, there was no merchandising team. It was just really, really lean.
So you say Sara Lee, and I probably make the same mistake many do, which is I think about a very narrow group of consumer packaged goods, but you're talking about clothing and fashion. So Sara Lee's much broader than probably most people assume.
Absolutely. It's sort of like a consolidated or a holding company almost, right? Because there was the bakery and coffee and intimate apparel. And so they were pretty diverse. They owned Coach at one time. I don't know if you know that. When I was there, they coached. So
I thought I knew stuff and I didn't know this at all.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, like, how hard was it to transition from, you know, packaged baked goods to working at Avon in beauty and cosmetics and skincare, but it was probably a pretty natural transition, actually.
It was a natural transition. Being in intimate apparel, understand, you know, having worked in department stores and understanding like that dynamic, that made it a lot easier. I think the part that was the big leap for me was the development piece. the product development piece and really learning how you partner with R&D and, formulations and packaging. And packaging development and cost management. So all of that was like, Avon is no joke about managing that, go to market, the product, packaging and all of that is the level of rigor that is committed to that brand, because they are so cost conscious and the commitment to execution because they have 26 campaigns a year.
Right.
It's very tight, efficient organization.
And then from Sara Lee to Avon and then to Estee Lauder, where you spend nearly a decade. And, the beauty and cosmetic space is one that's particularly attractive to young people who are sort of daydreaming about a future career. What advice do you give to an 18-year-old person who, loves shopping at Sephora and aspires to be an executive at a company like Estee Lauder one day? And I'm sort of asking for my niece.
About getting in the door or
before you even necessarily get to college and start to think about what you study. I just think it's one of those, for me, it was Nike. As a teenager, I just thought to myself, like, I don't even know who makes those commercials, but I know I want to do it. And then you start to kind of work backwards from what that goal is. At first I thought Nike made the ads and the shoes. Then you learn there's this thing called an ad agency. And I think for maybe teenagers who they love the space and it's a point of passion, they do the same thing. They go, I love shopping at Sephora. I love these products. I love how some of these products are sort of an expression of my values. I wonder how you even started a company like that. I wonder what I should be doing as a 17, 18-year-old, 19-year-old so that when the time comes, maybe I've studied the right things. Maybe I've given myself the right experiences. I have to think that a lot of young people have come to you and just been like, man, I want that job that you had. What should I be thinking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think at 18, I probably cannot tell you what you should be thinking. but in hindsight, I think the things that matter a lot are, I underestimated throughout my entire career, probably up until the last maybe 10 years, the importance of networking and building relationships and maintaining those relationships and follow through. Because, as much as, I was a finance undergrad and then I went to business school and ended up in those roles, there are many people who had completely different experiences, whether it be engineering or other roles that they had, and they ended up in the beauty business. So I think it comes down to being very clear on what your target customer or target brands are and casting a wide net. I mean, let's not be so, persnickety where we're like, oh, I only want to work at this one company. At the end of the day, it's about getting the experience and the exposure. And I think that means making forward progress. It means, committing to, trade organizations that get you exposure to, whether it be marketing or R&D or whatever area you want to work at in the beauty business. And then, really being hardworking once you get those opportunities.
There's the sort of devil wears Prada cliche about the fashion industry that I think, trickles into the beauty and cosmetics industry. Now that you're not in the beauty and cosmetics industry, can you confirm or deny whether those cliches are warranted in modern day?
Well, I think it's certainly competitive. As for the reasons you just highlighted, your niece wants to, work there. And so there's so many young people who want to be in that business and they're willing to do anything and accept anything to do that. So I think, people will treat you how you allow them, to treat you. But you have to set expectations for yourself and for others. And you also have to define how you want to treat others. And so, yes, there are, unique people who aren't necessarily so nice in every single organization that you work at. But you have to figure out, how you're going to respond to that. And sometimes it's just, putting your head down and, continuing on. And other times it's, a conversation where you kind of let people know what's okay and what's not okay for you.
Right. After Estee Lauder, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I don't think that, anybody should feel uncomfortable about that.
For sure. After Estee Lauder, you become CMO at the world's largest jewelry brand, Pandora. And, you know, no matter how prepared you are and all of the experiences that led to that moment, many CMOs say there's a certain trial by fire of being a first-time CMO. You sort of don't know what you don't know. Would you say that that was true for you as well as a first-time CMO at Pandora?
It was true on so many levels. And let me tell you why. Because I was a new CMO. I was a new CMO in a new industry. Even though I could parlay sort of my consumer understanding into this business, I was still completely new and green. And the business model was so complex because at the time, Pandora was much more franchised than owned channel. Right. And also multi-brand. So it was really complex just understanding like where dollars were being spent from a marketing standpoint, who we were talking to, and like trying to get that single view was like overwhelming. So stepping into that seat was probably one of the biggest step ups. It was probably second to stepping into the seat of being the SVP of Estée Lauder for different reasons, though.
So much in both of those jobs, when you go into a big company like this, I think to succeed, so much of yourself and so much emotional investment has to go into that. Are you prone to continue paying close attention to these companies that you used to work at and sort of armchair quarterbacking their decisions, good or bad?
Always. Yeah. 1000%. But also not just because of armchairing, you know, decisions, but also because, frankly, I have teams of people that, I mean, and at the end of the day, that's what it's really all about. And all of the folks that I've worked with in those places, I have, you know, a deep, deep affinity for and love for, and I want to see them do well. So I'm always cheering them on. I mean, I literally follow Estee Lauder stock, Pandora stock, follow them all on social media, checking them out, pinging my old president at Pandora, sometimes pinging the president of, you know, of Lauder and saying, you guys are doing great stuff. Love to see how Advanced Night Repair is still crushing it, you know? So yeah, continue to just be energized and watching them closely and always most of the time is cheering them on. Right. And just saying, you go, keep doing great things.
I think you're right. I mean, one of the most gratifying things that you don't realize you'll experience in a career is believing in somebody before they fully believe in themselves, just because they've been around long enough to experience some successes. And someone did that for you too.
Yeah.
And then you leave the job and you get to sort of give back those gifts you were given. You get to look at that person who came in as a entry level person who's running, you know, a global piece of business now. And you go, yeah, I always knew you were going to be something.
I always knew that. It's funny that you say that because my boss, my former boss, the guy who brought me into Estee Lauder when I got the job at Kellogg's, wrote this amazing post in social media. It's like, I know you're going to be a CEO one day. And like, it was just so sweet. And I love him. I love him deeply. So always nice to pay it forward and continue to celebrate those that have, you know, that you've touched in some way, whether small or large.
You accepted the position as CMO of Kellogg just this past September. Before we look ahead, just one more question looking back. Of all the places that you work, is there one company culture in particular that felt the most like home to you, that you sort of just have a natural predilection to want to sort of import the practices and the values from into this new job that you have?
Well, the interesting thing I would say, I can't narrow it down to one, but what I will tell you is that both Estee and Pandora had some things in common. One was that they were both really entrepreneurial in the very beginning of my working there. And then they started to evolve to a place where, there was a bit more structure and a bit more strategy in place. And so I like that hybrid, right? Because I think the need to be agile and fast, but also highly strategic is what every company and every brand has to do now. Especially coming out of COVID, but because of everything that's happening with the acceleration of digital and e-com and the rapid pace of change that we're going through, you know, you need those two together. And so I think that's kind of the culture that I really embrace. And then, of course, I enjoy an environment where it's a bit flatter. Where, you know, you kind of are a scrappy team that's coming together to build the future you know, together versus kind of a hierarchical place. So I think that was the one thing, that Lauder is a bit more hierarchical. Pandora is a bit flatter. So finding that, I think, balance is key as well. But everything's about speed and efficient speed and, you know, really sharp, putting a really sharp pencil to your execution and strategy. So
I can't even imagine what it's like to take over a CMO role in the middle of a pandemic when, you know, so much of the role is about commanding rooms and gathering large and small groups of people and, you know, giving directives that cascade. And I mean, of course you can do that over Zoom if you must, but just tell me a little bit about how that has affected your ability to sort of properly assume the role in the first 3 months.
I think the hardest part for me, especially for a Kellogg company that is highly relationship oriented, and Estee was like this as well, is building those relationships beyond just the surface, because it's all about credibility and trust. So I'm not able to go to lunch or, you know, have a cocktail or have dinner, stop by their office, running to them in the hallway and kind of hear how they're responding to, you know, something, you know, personal or something that happened over the weekend, or see the dynamics of, you know, whether it be their face or facial expressions in a meeting in reaction to a certain topic that was brought up. So it's all of the nonverbal cues and relationship aspects that I feel are challenged. With that being said, we do the best that we can. I think we're all giving each other a lot more latitude and being more empathetic and more and kinder, frankly, and maybe a little less difficult because we're in this environment. And so that has helped. And you know, the team has been really warm and very welcoming to me, and that's been great. So it's a good start, not ideal for sure.
It's interesting though. You're right. I mean, empathy is sort of the ultimate relationship accelerant.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And I do think there's an irony that, you know, there's a certain way we behave at work and there are certain facades that we can't help but create around ourselves as the professional itself when we walk out of our front door. And all of a sudden, I think there is a certain intimacy created by, you know, like my kids are on the other side of that door. I'm in living room right now. You're wearing a sweatshirt that I probably wouldn't have ever
seen. I'm wearing a hoodie.
I would have never seen you in a sweatshirt if I worked at Kellogg and I
saw
you.
You're so right.
So there is an interesting intimacy created by the distance that I think we didn't really calculate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. You get to know people on a different level, which could be viewed, to your point, as being a bit more intimate. And so, you know, hopefully that softens allows us to embrace each other a little bit more fully.
Well, to that point, how might someone describe your management style and maybe how has it evolved a little bit over the years?
Yeah. So my management style, I would say, is participative. As I was saying, I really ideally love a flat organization and sort of a coming together and team spirit on ideation and discussion and kind of problem solving. It's definitely high expectation. I want to push myself and others really hard. I think what has evolved over the course of time has been more around the confidence built from having to lean on others. Right. Because it's virtually impossible to know, you know, everything and be an expert in every area, nor should I try to be. That's the whole point of having a team. And so that confidence has come with time. My objective is to be stronger and be clearer in communicating purpose, intention, priorities, and helping the team kind of rally around those and stay focused. And so that communication piece is even more critical than it's ever been. And so I think that's also evolved over the course of time. And then I think, you know, I've become much more of a cheerleader than I ever was, because stylistically, I don't know if it's because my mom is a single parent and she didn't, you know, she wasn't like a rah-rah parent. So I was never like this overly you know, celebratory of accomplishments. Of course, I'm, you know, like, great job, but it wasn't to the level that I think it should be to really mobilize the team and continue to motivate them and keep them engaged and, you know, have them feel the level of, you know, ownership, accountability, and, you know, feel that success when it happens. And so I think that's probably the area that I've gotten better at over the course of time.
Yeah. And look, a big part of a job like yours is also, it's knowing when to be a cheerleader, and it's also knowing when to respectfully apply pressure.
For sure.
Is it difficult to know when to apply that pressure, know when to be a little bit, you know, for lack of a better term, to know when to be a little bit harder on people early going in the job without being able to develop those personal relationships? I know I'm asking you, like, you've been in the job for two months, right? So maybe
it's a balancing act. However, I am also a very transparent person. So I tend to, you know, share it and be very open. So open about expectations and also open about, you know, how, you know, we're performing to those expectations. So I would never, I actually think it's a disservice that's being done to the team if you ever aren't able to communicate that. So I work really hard at EQ. It's kind of like, you know, how I sort of see myself as being having high emotional intelligence and being able to, you know, kind of be tough on issues and soft on people. Like, that's the point.
Right. It's funny. You brought up the stock price earlier, and this is a question that I approach with such delicacy because I love to ask CMOs out of my real genuine curiosity, like, what is your relationship to the stock price of your company? And I will tell you before you answer, some CMOs just right away are like, oh man, I look at the stock price every day. Like, how could I not? Some, whether they look or not, they're really upfront about it. And others, it can make people uncomfortable to ask that question for some reason. So I will ask you, what is your relationship to the stock price of the company that you work at?
So I probably look at the stock price, maybe, I definitely look right around earnings time. But I don't know that, I mean, so that would be quarterly at minimum. It's a peripheral view for me because my team and I prepare, you know, investor relations and CEO and CFO with materials to support those meetings. So I actually am more focused on what comes out of it and the analyst's feedback. Right. And the questions, because those are really the ones that I have to, you know, or we as a team have to collectively respond to and ask ourselves, like, scratch our heads, like, why are we not, you know, seeing X, Y, and Z happening? And, you know, really taking that into our strategies for future so that we're really thinking about the shareholder value longer term. But it's not a front of mind for me. It's a peripheral view.
Do you purposely not look every day just so you don't get seduced by the daily ups and downs of it?
I am inherently a person that has finds a balance between short and long term. Like, I am always thinking long term. So I get the point of, you know, long term sustainable growth. At the end of the day, that's my job. My job is about that. And so the company's been around 114 years. I need to try to secure the next 100 years. I'm not going to be here for 100 years, but I need to be starting to build towards that. And so that's actually how I think. So it wouldn't make sense for me to look at it that frequently because it's all about expectations. And so I have to be thinking about how are we setting the right expectations so that the stock price achieves its full potential.
Right. Well, let's talk about setting expectations. And I think part of it is looking at you becoming the CMO of one of the world's most iconic companies at a fascinating and historic time in our country when our nation and our industry are facing a necessary reckoning with race. So I just wonder, how does that play into your vision as CMO in a way that maybe, you know, you weren't fully thinking about in previous roles, just in the context of what the world is going through and the role that we as leaders in our industry play in it? And And I also wonder, just how are you feeling about the current changes underway that you're witnessing our industry undergo?
Yeah. Well, frankly, I mean, I do think it's about time, and it's sad that situations happened that triggered it. But there is clearly a convergence of several factors, COVID being one of them, and us all kind of being idle, if you will, and our attention focused on what was happening with George Floyd. So it's a sad situation that had to be a wake-up call for all of us. But I have, you know, a deep sense of faith, you know, and my heritage inherently means that I am incredibly hopeful. I'm optimistic. I know that I come from a very long line of resilient people. So that gives me a lot of hope and expectation for the future. We're all still here. And it means that we have got to focus on building our purpose, aligning our purpose to try to secure the future for our kids and grandkids and the generations that are to come. So I'm hopeful. I'm incredibly hopeful. Yeah. But I know that this is a difficult time. It's an uncomfortable conversation to have, but it needs to be had.
Yeah.
And I often talk to a lot of friends and colleagues from global citizens, whether they're, you know, from Germany or Canada or other places. And they, you know, they're accustomed to dealing with pains and like laying them bare and then moving on, you know? And I just feel like we've never done that. We're like, you know, sugarcoating or glazing over our issues. And now it's time for us to kind of reckon with them. So.
Right. And at a company at the scale of Kellogg, I mean, so much of what we've talked about just within our own industry, brand side and agency side, is, you know, for decades, we've accepted a status quo of, you know, roughly 25% people of color. The number of women in our business has improved over the past decade, but, you know, the numbers are still not proportionate with general society. And when you're a company at such scale, again, whether a brand or an agency, it's very difficult to change those numbers in a meaningful way. Is it right to think about things that way, or does it sort of minimize the progress that's required to sort of, you know, put it in the context of numbers?
I think it's a starting point. And at the end of the day, we are a capitalistic society, right? So at the end of the day, we need to, like, it normalizes the conversation by putting, you know, the facts and figures on the table. But that shouldn't be the sum total of what we're trying to achieve, which is just parity with the percentage of the population. At the end of the day, there's so many different aspects of the D&I conversation that need to be integrated into how companies show up and what they say and what they do. And so I think it has to be integrated into the purpose and how, you know, how you're, you know, who you want to be, who's your customer, who do you want, you know, what do you believe in and what do you stand for?
Right.
And finally, we have so many organizations and big companies that are standing up and saying, you know what, we do care. We do want to reflect the larger population, in some saying disproportionately so, because that's who our customer is, or we see the societal value in embracing all people.
Shifting gears, a big part of your job is also interacting with agencies. First of all, is it safe to assume that you have more agencies now in your orbit as the CMO of Kellogg than at any other brand you ever worked at?
Safe to say.
And I would have to think so. And I just wonder, what are some of your thoughts on just getting the most out of agency partners? And I'm sure, you know, you've had some tightly held beliefs that you've learned along the way, but interacting with agency partners within the context of Kellogg's has to be a little bit different than anything that you've, you know, experienced to this time, to this point.
Yeah, because we actually have agencies that are working on different parts of the business. And some of it's inherited, and some of it is just, you know, heritage. So I think you know, net, my expectation is that the agency and agency partners will, you know, take the same approach as I would as a business leader, that they understand that, you know, we all need to be at the table, integrating and working together to solve the larger problems of the business and to drive the brand. So I believe in kind of this, you know, unified team dynamic with everyone at the table versus a fragmented approach where, you know, we're having this one call with this agency and they can't cross pollinate or they can't be in the same room. That just seems like an antiquated way of working. And I think what we're seeing from marketing ecosystems and agency relationships, it's key that we all are there at the table together.
I think one of the most fascinating things about just meeting and working with a lot of CMOs over the years is the spectrum of CMO sort of creative ability and desire, ranging from, I've worked with the CMOs of huge companies who they want to sit in and edit. They want to rewrite scripts with you in the room. They love the art, the creative artistry of it. And that just comes naturally to them. And all the way to the other side of the spectrum where I've seen CMOs who are, you know, several arm's lengths away from the creative process and the creative output, other than kind of, you know, show me the thing before it goes on air. And I've seen both succeed, by the way. I don't think there's a right or wrong, but I wonder where you sit along that spectrum.
I love the creative side, frankly, but I actually know my limits. And also I wouldn't want the creatives to feel, diminished. I like to be able to give feedback and let those, I love experts. And so I love to have experts do their work right, versus me trying to be this generalist who comes in and says, oh, I'm going to write your copy, or I'm going to tweak this, you know, format. I will set the objectives, the strategy, and then deliver the brief. I'll provide the feedback. And that's the way that I like to engage. And then we'll, you know, if we're going to do some testing, we'll evaluate the results of the testing and then give that feedback. But I don't really like to be in the trenches from that standpoint. Because I like to challenge everyone to be their best. And I think you get your best work that way. It's more empowering.
I was in the mid-2000s. I was at Crispin Porter sort of during the heyday of Crispin Porter. And we worked for a very large CPG that I will not name. And I felt, and it was a global CPG, and they hired us. And then I felt that in the hiring of us, it was sort of like, look at how bold and avant-garde we are. We've hired the disruptive, subversive agency. Now we will onboard you and teach you how we do things. And we sort of felt like, well, but if we do things the way that you guys have always done things, then won't we create the same outputs? So I just wonder, I'm sharing a little personal story with you, but I wonder, as part of your role, you know, how much do you feel like it's incumbent on those experts to challenge you and to sometimes make you feel uncomfortable or to sometimes, you know, stretch your limitations?
1,000,000%. Yeah. Like, if I should be challenged by my team, I should be challenged by my partners in the regions, I should be challenged by my boss, I should be challenged by the agency, I should be challenged by what's happening externally. Everyone should be challenging. That's how you end up getting to the best. We should all be challenged to be thinking differently. And so that's so important, but not necessarily something that's easy to do, especially from an agency standpoint.
Yeah. I think in business and in life, we say that we want to be challenged and then it happens. And it's like, crap, this is what it feels like. You know,
it
can be an unpleasant feeling. Yeah.
It's an unpleasant feeling, but it is the right thing to do. And honestly, we're also on a change journey to some degree. So we have to be challenged. We actually had a global leadership summit last week for 3 days, and we brought in one of our investor relations, one of our investors at one of the firms, and he challenged us big time. Right. And that's not easy to stand before, you know, almost 1,000 leaders and, you know, tell us what we do well and tell us what we do not so well. But that's exactly what we need to hear. Yeah. For sure.
I think one of the great art forms of a CMO at a company at the size and scale and iconography of Kellogg's is, you know, companies at that scale have multiple agencies, as we discussed, working on your business, and sometimes multiple agencies working on the same business. And for, you know, for some clients, there's very defined swim lanes. And then for other clients and brands, those lines can be quite blurred. And, you know, look, today it's a jump ball and tomorrow it's collaboration. And you get, you know, I just wonder, like, what is your view on interagency collaboration? And has that been a challenge at all in these first 3 months, just starting to think about, you know, putting those practices into place?
Foundationally, I don't see it as a challenge, but in these early days, I'm still sort of figuring in the relationships out and getting to know all the players.
Right.
But I think, as I was kind of saying or alluding to earlier, it's the way for, we're all thinking from a different sort of vantage point or lens. And so the way to get to the best is to have that tension created together. And I really believe that. And I know it's uncomfortable, as you said, or as we said earlier, but it's important. It's critical now.
I always ask chief creative officers or agency people, I ask, like, you know, do you still get nervous before client meetings? And I ask that because, you know, I've spent my life in client meetings, and sometimes my, you know, listen, before I started to talk to you today, the palms start to sweat a little bit. It's like, it takes me back. It's just a natural reaction. So I don't know, I'm going to guess you don't get nervous before agency meetings, but I'll ask you, you're this very poised person. Are there any types of meetings that you still get nervous before?
Excuse me. You know, I'm new to the organization. So frankly, I get, is nervous the word? I get a little jittery, let's say, around most of the, like, when I'm meeting new people in this journey, because I want to be, I want to listen well, I want to be attentive, I want to be empathetic, I want, you know, to ask good questions. So I think in the early stages of just meeting people, I've been a little bit more nervous than maybe I am naturally. Right. And I actually led a panel session at our Global Leadership Summit. And that was a little bit, it was a little nervous. I was a little nervous because of the format, you know, you're on video and then you're having to, you know, toss back and forth between these two panelists and, you know, draw conclusions. And so that was a little bit, that was a moment of being a little bit nervous as well. So yeah, it varies. In the simplest terms, it varies, but, you know, being a new person, I definitely still get nervous.
When you bring up big brand CMOs, one of the first things that comes up is like, and the number always changes, it keeps getting shorter. They go, oh, well, you know, the average lifespan of a CMO is like 14 months. It's 11 months. Well, now it's like 4 days. The average lifespan is four, you know. So just in that context, like, I mean, in terms of, you want to be your loosest, most authentic self, but you're also aware, it's not a Kellogg's fact. It's an industry fact.
That's right.
You know, within that context, coming into the job, what is your mentality in terms of how aggressive should we be out of the gates versus kind of feeling things out and, you know, allowing yourself to slowly get acquainted?
So this, I've been incredibly deliberate in this transition versus what I did with Pandora. So Pandora, I had like 90 days to deliver something. It was like, I started on January 4th and I had to deliver Mother's Day by like, you know, April 2nd or something like that. But with Kellogg's, I actually said, I'm going to take the full 90 days to just ask questions and not sort of project and really listen. Sort of, you know, I have this book that, you know, first 90 days, and it says you should learn and you're constantly shaping your agenda for sure along the way, but take the time to learn and listen and hear the perspective, the journey that the organization has been on, the journey that the leaders are on, where people feel like the biggest opportunities are, and then have that help you shape your agenda. So I've been super, super focused on doing just that. Right. I'm almost at 90 days though.
So then no more questions. So now, then you just have to be the answer
person.
So now
person. I just have to.
All answers. No more questions. Okay. All answers.
No more questions.
In order to enjoy success, we must also endure some failure. Do you have a favorite failure from your career?
At Lauder, we were launching a BB. I don't know if you ever heard of this. BB creams. Have you ever heard of BB creams?
I haven't.
Okay. They were all the rage and during my time at Lauder, and we were going to launch a whole, you know, collection of them. And they were, you know, it was a trend that had risen out of Korea. And it was sort of like a tinted moisturizer. And we were launching a whole collection of them, and they, before they even launched, you know, they were starting to fail really rapidly. So it was,
did they have speckles in them?
They have pigment in them.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're speckles, but they do have pigment, that helps to give you like a smooth, beautiful, flawless finish, to your skin. Sort of like a foundation, not a foundation, not a tinted moisturizer, but something in that ilk, if you will.
But people weren't feeling it.
They weren't feeling it. We had a plan to launch too many of them. We had over segmented the market, instead of kind of going after it with one. And it ended up just being a dismal failure, frankly.
The over segmentation, was that on you a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point, Charisse. What was that about? What were you thinking? I was thinking we're going to go after all the key benefits that consumers need, because it's closer to skincare than it is to foundation. And that was just over segmented, way too segmented.
I mean, as an observer, I think one of the hardest parts of the role of CMO is that there's so many smart people leading up to decisions that they need you to make, that sometimes decisions feel like they're like a foregone conclusion. Like so much work has gone into getting to you, you know, not you specifically, but you just have so many sort of senior people that it's a little bit related to what you just said. Like, does it almost feel sometimes like it's hard to stop the train once it has gained so much momentum, where it's like, you know, looking back at that example you just gave, like, was there even a different outcome? Could you have stopped that train?
Good question. Probably not at the time, because the expectation from the corporation was that we were getting behind this direction, so we should go after it. And we were the leading skincare brand around the globe. So like, why wouldn't you, you know?
Right. There was an inevitability to it.
There is that. I do think that, I think your point about the trains left the station, but then again, the role that you have and the reason you're there, is to make the tough decisions and the tough calls. And I think that courage is everything, especially now, and in our company, it's a key value of ours, key, growth competency. So you have to push hard, to make sure that we're making the right decision and make the tough calls, even when they're not popular.
Yeah. Especially in the age of doing business in COVID, is there something in particular that you've gotten better at saying no to?
I've been a bit more intent and purpose focused about what gets on my calendar. So I've had to, just to kind of be really, really, precious about my time. Because yeah, it's easy to get bogged down and, you know, so much is coming at you from, whether it be externally or internally. So many people have reached out to me, you know, before I even started, saying they want to meet me. And, you know, so you just have to juggle all of that. And so I have to be really precious about my calendar and like making sure I'm getting to, what I need to get to in the 90 days once they're up.
Yeah. And along that journey of being able to ask questions on that 90 days, I also wonder, it doesn't have to be a 90 day thing, but is there a recent piece of work from another brand that has maybe made you jealous? Maybe made you say, man, we need to take inspiration from that. We need to be more like that as a company. Is there something that has just really caught your eye?
You know, it's tricky for my new role, but I'm always admiring brands. I love Crocs. I recently joined the board, became a board member for Crocs. And I have been, but before that, I was really intrigued by their approach to bringing products to market, the collaboration, you know, approach, and how it's made this product so democratic across men, women, and children, and aspirational in some cases. So I constantly look at them. I also bought a Peloton, so I'm, you know, on that movement. and they recently did a collaboration with Beyonce. I don't know if you're okay. And so I thought that was really smart and a great way for Beyonce to remain relevant, but also for Peloton to tap into some of her amazing, you know, fans. So just thinking about how brands use collaborations is something that is top of mind for me in licensing, and what that means from a longer term standpoint is an area that I have heightened attention to, let's say.
The amazing thing about the Beyonce piece is, like, you know, the genius of Peloton, it's such a personal product. It's in your home. Absolutely. And it's as personal to you and to I as it is to Beyonce, who's very protective of her brand. But when she gets on that, it's not that different than when you or I get on it.
That's right.
And for them to figure that out and tap into that and basically, you know, create a partnership that doesn't come around for many brands was just so shrewd.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, I think another big part of leadership is it's not about being great at every single thing. It's about knowing what you're great at. And it's about surrounding yourself with people who do that, which you're not great at. I wonder, you know, is there a quality you admire in another CMO that maybe you wish you had a little bit more of?
I think probably, you know, elevated, like the communication to the organization about the elevated role of marketing is probably one that I'm constantly challenging myself on. And I have a group of CMOs that I stay really close to and am always picking their brain about. So I don't know that it's necessary envy, but just how do you continue to have drive that message? Because it's so important, as we talked about brand purpose and, you know, now the role of digital and how that connects end to end and, you know, analytics. And so all of that, you know, sustainability, ESG initiatives. So all of that kind of it's the fulsomeness of what the company does and trying to drive those conversations to make sure that there's connective tissue and consistency and that we're looking at everything through that lens, I think is just the ongoing challenge.
Right.
So it's just the ongoing dialogue of keeping those pieces at the forefront for the organization and members of the executive team.
The best brands are trying to have these ongoing relationships with customers. And when you look at the Kellogg portfolio, there's so many products that have just kind of been weaved throughout people's lives. I ended my note, you know, meeting you with, like, just, you know, a quick note that Cheez-Its have been an important part of my life since childhood. And
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah. You know, if you really love this interview, just I'll hit you with the address. You can ship me a few boxes.
Please
good.
Do.
And,
please
do. But I wonder if that's true for you. When you took the job, did you look at the portfolio and kind of think, like, man, I have a personal connection with this one particular product?
Absolutely. Like, I think about, like, I always ate cornflakes. That's what we ate with my mom and I. But my uncle ate Frosted Flakes. And I spent every summer in Arkansas with my uncle because my grandmother would go fishing at 5 a.m. every single day. And so I was home with my uncle. And so sitting home with my uncle, him eating Frosted Flakes and us hanging out is like one of the fondest memories of my childhood. So absolutely. Kellogg's has been with me from the beginning.
And it's cool to think about some of these brands as, like, you know, sleeping giants that, absolutely, you know, the role you're in, it's like you're a steward. You know, the company will live on long after we're retired. But totally, you sort of get this chapter of your career to be a steward of these iconic brands.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is there an aspiration in particular for Kellogg's in 2021 that you have on a vision board circled behind you somewhere?
It's exactly what you know, we were talking about a few minutes ago, which is living our purpose, our vision and purpose. We just kind of recrafted it. And so it's all about ensuring that we live up to that and we bring that to life in everything we do. It's the lens that we're viewing ourselves, you know, as employees, stakeholders, you know, that our consumers are seeing us through that. And so it's all about bringing that to life in everything we do. So super, super excited and energized about 2021 and how we put it at the forefront.
Charisse, before I let my guests go, I like to ask them, what is the word or phrase of corporate jargon that makes your skin crawl the most? Everyone's got one.
When I tell you, you're going to be like, but you said it 25 times in this. My husband and I laugh all the time because it's super excited. And I've said it a million times, but he's like, everyone says it when they start the call, when they end the call, I'm super excited. I'm super excited. And I cringe because I say it too much, but super excited. I've got to find another descriptor.
You got to pop the thesaurus open and just store up a couple backups.
Exactly.
Charisse, I'm very excited for you. I'm appreciative that you agreed to do this interview. You know, it's not easy as you're still getting your sea legs in a company as iconic as Kellogg to, you know, answer questions. So it's an incredible time in your career to kind of get you and get into your brain a little bit. And I think of all the ways I'm excited for you, the thing I'm most excited about is one day you'll return to the office and you'll find out the actual heights of the people you've been spending 100 hours. Like, you know, this lady might be 7 feet tall. This guy might be 4 feet tall. You don't know.
I have no idea. That is so true. That's the major unlock.
It was so lovely to meet you, and it's so great to talk to you. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you so much to Charisse. Thank you, as always, to the executive producer of this podcast, my good friend, Mr. Jeff Fiorello at JSM Music. Go to JSM and hit up Jeff for all of your audio needs in the marketing industry, and they'll treat you right. And until we talk again, please subscribe, rate, review, share the podcast with a friend or colleague. And we'll be back to you in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. Until then, peace.